Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled, How to Speak with Integrity in an Angry and Polarized World, by Lama Tom Broadwater. The Buddha established some easily understood ways to speak. In this talk, we will look at those ways of speaking. While we will use the teachings of the Foundation Vehicle, we will look at the other turnings to enhance our understanding of effective speech. Sources include Kempo Carter Rinpoche and Shantideva. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
First of all, I want to thank you for the gift of your time. From a Buddhist perspective, there's nothing more precious than your time. So thank you for being here. And I hope that what I have to say may be of some value to you so that you aren't wasting your time. So the topic I chose today was how to speak in a world that is angry and polarized. But when I got to thinking about it, you know, you want to know how to speak at all times. It is an angry time and it is a polarized time. But how do we speak in general so that we are helpful to other beings? And I also thought, you know, if we focus too much on the anger, too much on the polarization, we're liable to play a sort of a weird game called something like, ain't it all just awful? Eric Byrne, who was a Canadian psychologist, spoke about this game of, ain't it just awful? He said, people who play this game overtly express distress, but covertly are gratified at the prospect of the satisfaction that they'll wring from this misfortune. So we all sit around and say, oh, ain't it awful? How bad it is. But if we do that, nothing gets accomplished. So I have to do a little confession here. I have to do a little disclosure here. I've often played this game of ain't it just awful. We gather around as a group and sort of discuss the worst happenings of the day. But in the end, such talk is totally, completely useless. No reason to do that. So the emphasis this morning on this talk is going to be about what comes out of our mouths. We're going to do that rather than talking about what bothers me or what might bother you about what's happening in the world. We'll take a look at how we can speak in an ethical, liberated, and liberating way, according to Buddhist teachers. According to Tibetan Buddhist teaching, the Buddha taught in three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. It's what they're called, the three turnings of the wheel of the Dharma. This talk is not about those three turnings, but I will say this much about the content of this talk comes from the fundamental or foundational vehicle, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And then towards the end of this talk, I'll discuss speech within the context of the Mahayana and Vajrayana, but I'll only do that very briefly. So the first and perhaps most obvious point to make about speech is that it is so powerful. It is so powerful. It can lift up a nation. One person giving a talk can inspire an entire nation. Or one person in their speech can send millions to the gas chambers. That's how powerful speech is. Shanti Davis said that words do not have arrows or swords, yet they can tear the mind of men to pieces. Speech is powerful. And the other point about speech is how pervasive it is. If you think about it in a given day, how much time you spend in talking to others, or at least talking to yourself, that's a form of speech, internal speech. But most of what we're going to talk about today is external speech. If it's true that speech is powerful, if it is true that it is pervasive, then training this speech can be a powerful tool to our liberation. So training our speech is a terribly important practice. It's also taking our practice off of our cushions and into the world. People often say, how do I take my practice off the cushion? Well, the answer is, in some respects, pretty simple. Train your speech. You use it a lot. In the foundational vehicle, the speech takes a great deal of priority. There's the Eightfold Path, and speech is the third priority within that Eightfold Path. So it's really important. The funny thing particularly about the foundational vehicle is there's an incredible number of don'ts. Don't do this, don't do that. And I thought about this, and I don't know exactly why that's the case, but I think it's sort of like we're like little kids prone to stick our fingers in on stoves or run out in traffic when we shouldn't. So the Buddha saying, don't, to us beginners. And so he has a lot of don'ts in regards to our speech. And we're going to talk about those today. Perhaps when we're a little bit more matured in our practice, these don'ts won't take such prominence. But nonetheless, for you and me, they still deserve our recollection. And that's what we're going to do today. So what are these foundational don'ts? Well, the first one is don't lie. In regards to our speech, in training our speech, the first don't is don't lie. Now, for most of us, that sounds, well, of course. Of course. We all believe that lying is wrong. And we know that lying causes untold suffering. And from a worldly standpoint, it can cause a great deal of embarrassment. So let's define what a lie is. A lie is to intentionally mislead others when they expect the honest truth. People lie intending to mislead. Now, I want to make a distinction here. There's a distinction between lying and ourselves being misled. Let me give an example. Let me think of an example. I may say it's going to rain tomorrow, but it doesn't rain. So I was misled. I was misled by what I thought the truth was. So I may be misled, but in my speech, I'm still being truthful. I'm telling what I think is the truth, and I am not intentionally trying to mislead you. I'm trying to help you. But I can be, even in that effort, mislead. So it's really important sometimes when we're saying what we think the truth to be, to say precisely that. I think. And if our degree of certainty is low, we should say, well, I'm not sure about this. If our degree of certainty is pretty high, we can say, I'm pretty sure this is so. This keeps us honest. So what are the reasons we may lie? They're pretty obvious, I think. We may lie to avoid embarrassment. No, I didn't do that. I may exaggerate my virtues. I want to impress you. In the same light, I might want to hide my faults. No, I'm not like that. I may promise you something I can't give you. I may want to gain advantage. I may want to spare you your feelings. And sadly, but most destructively, I may actually want to harm. There's a real irony about lying. The liar thinks that what he does, well, it's not going to cause that much harm. No big deal. Whereas the person lied to often feels violated and betrayed, even by small, little lies. In our less reflective moments, we might say, well, I'd never lie. I'd never tell an untruth. That's very, very dangerous to think that way. Sam Harris, who's a philosopher and an author, has said, the opportunity to deceive others is ever present. And it's tempting. Few of us are murderers, he said. Few of us are thieves. But at one time or another, we've all told a lie. We may live under the illusion that I would never tell a lie. But here's the sad fact. If we do not acknowledge the fact that we are capable of lying, if we can't acknowledge that, there's a real possibility that when we actually are tempted to lie, we do, because I never tell a lie. So I think it's important that we recognize, acknowledge the fact that within us there is this capacity to tell an untruth. And that's clarifying. That's liberating to recognize it. And it also keeps us on our guard to watch our speech. Let's consider now the damage that's done by lying, particularly to relationships. Nietzsche, a German philosopher, said, I think, what's really key to all of this. He said, I am not upset you lied to me. What I'm upset about is that because you lied to me, I can never trust you again. Lying, even in small matters, can destroy relationships. How can I ever trust you if in this little matter you could not tell the truth? How could I trust you in a larger matter? Sometimes we lie by omission. We fail to tell something that might be relevant to a situation. Let's say a loved one is drinking a lot. And he says to us, I'm getting along just fine, no problem. But you see clearly the dysfunction in that person's life. And you admit not giving him feedback. And you do that consciously. I don't want to confront this unpleasant truth with this individual. But if we were honest in that situation, in similar situations like that, if we were honest, that honesty could force this dysfunction to the surface and help that person, maybe for the first time, to deal with his difficulties. Now, the point here also should be made, you just don't go out and blurt out bluntly other people's faults or their dysfunction. If you want to tell the truth to someone, you want to tell it kindly, without malice, gently. And in this case in particular, where you're telling somebody something they might not want to hear, you tell it in a timely manner, at the right place, with the right people. But omission in this case is not a virtue. It's a form of lying. Also, telling unpleasant truths to people can help maybe save them a lot of time. Say someone, and I'm just giving an example off the top of my head, say someone wants to be a great painter and go out and make lots of money painting. And you're very sure by looking at the work that it's not going to be a great painter. Now, you can say, as a matter of taste, you don't know for sure, but you could say, you know, I don't know that you're going to make a lot of money doing that. You might save them a lot of wasted time doing it. Now, if they want to do it just for pleasure because they like to, well, that's another matter. But when someone seriously asks you a question that's related to their vocation, to their life's work, you might have to tell them an unpleasant truth. The other thing that I really think happens when we omit telling people the truth is that we are playing judge and jury about what truths other people should hear. You're not capable of understanding that. I'm not going to tell you that. You wouldn't be able to handle it. You're playing judge and jury. And if you're, let's look at it from the other side, me being ignorant of this, would I not appreciate the fact that you told me the truth? You didn't hide the truth from me, at least as you see it. At least that's the way I see it. Now, there are such things as minor matters of taste. You know, someone comes dressed a certain way and they ask you, how do I look? And maybe this outfit or whatever doesn't exactly fit what you think looks nice, but you wouldn't say, you don't have to say anything about that. You could artfully dodge the issue. You could just simply hold your tongue. And something that I often do with people in that situation, I say, well, what do you think about that? And let them determine the truth of that matter. You know, we may be tempted to tell small lies for any number of reasons. And we've sort of indicated earlier what those are. And the problem here is it's a slippery slope. Mark Twain had something to say about this. He talked about the advantage of the simple truth over a small lie. He said, the advantage to telling the truth is you don't have to remember anything. If I tell a lie, I got to remember, oh, I told that. And whatever I say subsequent, even if it's maybe 4 years from now, has to be consistent with the original lie. How much simpler it is to tell the truth. In this rather degenerate time, we may see lying pop up anywhere. But when we encounter a truthful person, they are truly a gem. They are a refuge for us. They say what they mean what they say, and you can rely on that. When I go to them, I know I'm going to be told the truth. And you further know that what they tell you to your face, they will say behind your back. So the Buddha said in the early sutras, he said, never knowingly speak a lie for your own advantage, or for the advantage of another, or any advantage whatsoever. In another sutra, the Buddha showed Rahula, his son, a bowl, and in that bowl was just a little bit of water. And what he said was, Rahula, the accomplishment of a man who would be inclined to lie, the achievement of such a man is equal to the amount of water in that bowl. And as I said, there was just a little tiny bit of water. So it's very clear. The Buddha saying, don't lie. So we can take on speech as a mindful practice. We can look into our own lives. And when we start telling some untruth, we can stop and look at our motivation. Is it fear? Is it greed, recognition, fear of rejection? Worse yet, is it because we want to harm somebody? We may fail at times in this commitment. We can do that. We can fail in this commitment. But that's why it's called a practice. The practice of truthfulness. The practice of truthfulness in our speech. So not lying is the first element of right speech, the first don't. If we think about it, truth is actually the goal of all Dharma practice. Actually, the realization of ultimate truth is the goal of all Dharma practice. So naturally, we have to be committed to telling the truth on the conventional level. Meditation is certainly at the heart of our practice, and being mindful of our speech is one of the ways to take our practice off the cushion. That's really important. And since speech is so much of our life and so pervasive, it can be something we do every day. Be mindful of our speech. Mindful speech and a life led by mindful speech is a life being led to liberation and liberating others. So the first aspect of rightful speech or right speech is do not lie. The second aspect of right speech is to refrain from gossip and those words that cause disharmony. The Buddha said, very simply, what one has heard here is not reported there. What is heard there is not reported here. And he goes on and he says, one unifies those divided by one's words. One encourages those united by one's words. One delights in unity and concord. A little practical aspect here of gossip. One of the things I've learned over the years, and it's like always the case, at least in my situation, the person that will gossip to me will gossip about me. Don't think otherwise. So taking in and being part of gossip involves us in a very sticky web. That's from a practical standpoint. The other thing that we often do, we freely share our judgments about others. We like doing that. And there's many reasons for that. We like to exaggerate our own virtues by comparing them to someone who we want to report as being less virtuous. We want to hide our own faults, gain advantage, and again, sadly, harm others. I would challenge you without, and don't tell anybody you're doing this, I would challenge you one day never to talk about someone who's not present for the conversation. I challenge you to that. It's really hard. And I mean, even if it's something good, not to, to mention them in the conversation. If they're not there, don't talk about them. See what that does in terms of how you think about your own speech. That's a real challenge. This gossip, this talking about others, it can emerge in any organization, but it devastates a Buddhist community. It's a matter of fact that jealousies and rivalries can emerge in a Buddhist community. Gossip becomes the norm, particularly when there's no effort to stop it. It's so sad. The organization can falter. And in the case of a Dharma organization, the vital energy that can be produced within the organization dissipates, gets lost. Ugly divisions, even schisms, can arise. Mindful speech is particularly important in a Dharma organization. So don't gossip. The next aspect of right speech is not to speak harshly, angrily, abusively. That's really important. So be aware of the energy behind your speech. No one that I know likes being the object of harsh speech. It hurts. It really hurts. Harsh speech does not create an environment for dialogue. Now, this doesn't mean we have to suppress how we feel. If anger arises in our minds, if hurt or resentment arises, it doesn't mean we suppress it. But mindful speech does mean that we try to find a way to express it in such a way that the other person or persons can actually hear you. If you speak harshly, the consequence is people are immediately taken aback and on the defensive. So it doesn't mean you don't express your anger or your frustration or whatever emotion that may arise in a conversation. But it does mean that you manage it mindfully. How can I say this in a way they will hear me and not be taken aback? Again, harsh words are less likely to create understanding and much more likely to create hurt and resentments. Here's one last aspect of right speech that we'll talk about. And it's called useless speech. Don't engage in useless speech. Useless speech isn't necessarily malicious, you know? It's just, you know, blah, 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 blah. We've all engaged in that. It's often inspired just our wanting to say something in the conversation, wanting to edge our way into the conversation. It can be prompted simply by embarrassed silence. I gotta say something. Although sometimes when there's silence, they're actually, if we allow it, it can actually connect us to other people. But a lot of times we do feel embarrassed in our silence, and so we want to speak anything just to break the silence. And we all like to share with people our opinions. The Buddha said in one of the sutras, and I quote, "One speaks at the right time in accordance with the facts. One speaks of the Dharma. Such a person's speech is such a treasure, moderate and full of sense." So the Buddha sets a very high standard. And actually, in this particular passage, he's speaking to monastics. It's sort of expected that in the monastery, the speech that is heard is speech about the Dharma. Well, you and I have families. You and I have friends. You and I go to workplaces. And our speech is a lubricant for social interactions to make work efficient. And it's a part of commercial transactions. So it's not like we never engage in pleasant conversation. That's not our vocation. But it would be interesting in a day's time if you start looking at just how much of your speech is self-referencing. I this, I that, me this. And try to look at how sometimes that's sort of useless. I mean, our opinions, our tastes, I like this, I like that, I don't like this, I don't like that, may have very little meaning to the person being spoken to. So maybe cutting back on our self-referencing might actually lead to our being able to hear more about what other people are saying. It might lead to actual better conversations. So again, the Buddha in this foundational vehicle sets some very high standards for our speech. But again, he's urging us to use this extraordinarily powerful tool that we have, speech. He's urging us to use it in a mindful and purposeful way. And that way leads to a path of liberation. A blogger by the name of Mark Foust has developed a little acronym. An acronym is a name formed from the initial components of a longer phrase. Foust's acronym is WAIT, WAIT. So before you speak, we stop and think. What am I thinking? Why am I talking? One of those two. What am I thinking? Or why am I talking? This adds a bit of mindfulness to our speech. This could be particularly helpful in moments of high emotion. What am I thinking? Why am I talking? It's a moment for awareness. What applies to speaking, in many respects, applies to our listening. So without playing a game of ain't it just awful, we can briefly look at some of the obstacles we have to listening. It's a fact that there are tremendous forces within our lives that keep us addicted and distracted in a virtual world. Even the pace of our lives have been quickened by the rhythms of our devices. If it takes an extra second for us to get to the next website, we're saying, hurry up, come on, let's get going, let's move. So this distractedness, this hurry up and get there attitude provides some real barriers for our listening. So we have to admit the fact that to listen requires us to overcome this distractibility that has become habitual with us. We have to be more intentional when we're listening, much more intentional, and much more aware. But if we are more intentional, more aware, we're less likely to be reactive. In listening, we actually have to intend to connect and care about the person being listened to. And we have to care about what they're saying. So if we approach listening like this, we can avail ourselves of other tools. If we're less reactive, if something sort of stirs us and we're able to not react immediately in that space, we can avail ourselves of additional tools in our own wisdom to speak wisely to another being. So I will give a little teaching that I learned a long time ago about how to deal with angry people. For I think about 11 years, I was in charge of a adolescent home for abused kids. If you want to see the stormy waves of samsara, visit a group home for abused children. There's a lot of anger going on there. And what I learned was that normally when we're dealing with angry folks, their voice is, you know, loud and angry. And so we think that we have to be a little louder, a little stronger, a little clearer than them. Of course, they go this way and it escalates. So rather than do this, what we would do in the group I'm sitting was we'd actually speak slower and more softly. And what happens is, rather than us entering the angry, violent world of the adolescent by our soft, kind, clear speech, we're actually inviting them into our world. And it works. Most of the time, not always. When someone is triggered by some enormously emotional traumatic event from the past, other methods may need to be employed. But the primary one is, as I said, speaking slowly, clearly, softly, inviting the person to enter into your world. You know, to deal with an angry person, we have to practice a great deal of empathy. Lama Kathy on her Facebook website put up a post from the poet Longfellow, the American poet Longfellow. And he said, if you could read the secret history of our enemies, people that are angry, if we could read that secret history, we would find in each man's sorrow and sufferings enough to disarm all hostility. Oftentimes, behind anger is hurt. So I've spent most of this talk about using the foundational vehicle, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And the Buddha gives us clear instructions on how to speak. Now, within the Mahayana tradition of mind training, there are similar kinds of do's and don'ts. The great path of awakening has a number of these don'ts. And I'll just mention a couple of them, ones that come to my mind. The one is, don't speak of others' injured limbs. That's in the great path. In other words, don't speak about others' limitations. Don't discuss other people's faults. The next one is, don't ponder others. I love this one. Bluntly put, it means mind your own business. Don't think about the affairs of other people. They got to take care of their affairs. We got to take care of others. Don't ponder others. The other is, don't be excited by cutting remarks. That's also translated as, do not engage in malicious sarcasm. In Tibetan, the image here of sarcasm is throwing a rock wrapped in wool. When we see it flying through the air, it just looks like a fluffy little ball. But when it hits the person, it's a rock. It hurts. So it's the image here is a rock wrapped in wool, malicious sarcasm. It can appear to be very clever, even humorous, but the intention is to harm. There are others, but we don't have time to go into all of them. There is in the Mahayana turning of the Wheel of Dharma lots of do's and don'ts like this. And we don't have time, again, as I say, to get into them. We can also note here, and I'm going to now talk about the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, how speech is viewed for the rest of this talk. And there are distinctions we can make within the vehicles. In retreat, in our morning prayers, we said what is called the Dum Sum Sojong. And in the section called Individual Liberation Section, the foundational section, we pray, may our moral discipline be without defect. May our moral conduct be stainless and undefiled. So here, when we talk about moral conduct, about our speech, we're talking somewhat rule-based, and we want to do this perfectly. And we want to do it in conformance with a moral code. In the Mahayana section of that same prayer, we say something a little different. We pray, I vow to become the sustenance of all beings. I undertake the responsibility for the welfare of all beings. So in the foundational vehicle, we're concerned about our own moral conduct. We don't lose that perspective in the Mahayana, but we deepen it by saying, what I am doing ethically, morally, in terms of the paramitas in this case, what I am doing ethically and morally is not just for me, but for all beings. And so that's slightly different perspective that we take in the Mahayana. It's a vast undertaking, an undertaking where we say we're going to bring all beings to liberation. So that's what we aspire to. In a way, in the Mahayana, love and compassion trump any particular moral code. Let's give you a simple example. Let us say we were back in Germany, and we were hiding one of our Jewish friends, and the police came to our door and they said, "Are there any Jews here?" Never lie. In this case, love and compassion and our concern for others, we lie. So the Mahayana is more focused on a vaster kind of conduct. And there's something even vaster. Rinpoche encouraged us to transcend the idea that I am doing something, and that I'm doing something for another. And he says this in the Dharma Paths. And he wrote, or he said, give birth to something ultimate, effortless, like the arising and disappearing of the clouds in the sky. So in terms of our moral conduct, there is no act, no thought of doing, and no person to whom I am doing it. He said, just cut off all of that and remain in a state of awareness. The third turning of the wheel of Dharma, the Vajrayana, the Buddha gave us skillful ways to access this state of awareness that Rinpoche is talking about. And it's an access through Tantra. So in our morning prayers, we said during retreat and are encouraged to say even after retreat, we say, I generate the intention to attain the supreme and unsurpassable awakening of Samanta Bhadra, timeless awareness, awakened before the very beginning, which is the Vajrayana way of saying Buddhahood. So they say in the Vajrayana, we take the result as the path. So we see ourselves as already enlightened. And in this view, see our guru, our teachers as the Buddha, and our Vajra brothers and sisters as enlightened. We see them in pure light, in a pure light. And we inhabit a sacred world. And here, in this sacred world, mantra is our speech. Mantra is the sacred expression of the unity of sound emptiness, liberating speech. So speech has importance in all three vehicles. But in all cases, we don't dismiss the foundational, the do's and don'ts the Buddha gave us in the first turning. But rather, in each vehicle that we enter, we develop an even more profound understanding of what speech is and what our conduct is in the Mahayana, foundational vehicle. We are talking about speech in terms of what we should and should not do as moral conduct. In the Mahayana, we're taking a larger view that our conduct, our speech, is leading ourselves and all beings to Buddhahood. In the Vajrayana, we're through the creative use of our imagination, seeing that sacred world, seeing the result, and imagining what our speech, enlightened speech, is. So I hope I've not given you whiplash by running through all the various vehicles as it relates to speech. But I'm going to conclude here now by saying, if there's one takeaway from this talk, I suggest the acronym WAIT. What am I thinking and why am I talking? And finally, if you are looking for an object, a subject, I should say, for your speech, for the practice of right speech. I suggest you take the person you are closest to, a wife, a spouse, a work partner. Who do you talk to the most? And begin there practicing right speech. And then, once that practice has been developed, work out to all people. Again, thank you very much for being present. I hope that our time together has been worth your while. Let's dedicate the merit of this talk for the benefit of all beings, that we overcome all of our obstacles to right speech, and that by doing so, we bring all beings to full enlightenment. Thank you very much. Bless you, and may you all have a really good week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.